Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why does it cost so much to be well in America? Last year, we spent $3 trillion on health care, more than the next 10 biggest spenders in the world combined, even though U.S. outcomes are often worse than those in countries that spend far less per capita. 60% of personal bankruptcies are tied to medical bills, in a country where a hospital stay of just a few days can result in tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in bills. So what sort of changes has the Affordable Care Act delivered? Where does it fall short of the promises made or implied by its champions? And who is getting rich off sick Americans? Journalist Stephen Brill has written for Time, The New Yorker, and The New York Times Magazine, and he is founder of the Yale Journalism Initiative. His new book is called America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You point out something that I'm not sure everybody thinks about. Healthcare is America's largest industry and average family's largest expense over time.
That's true, and we don't think about it in part because traditionally most of us or majority of us have had health insurance, and it's only in the last 5 or 10 years that our health insurance has gotten so expensive and the bills covered by health insurance have been less adequate. There have been higher deductibles, higher coinsurance payments, less coverage of drugs, and while that's been going on, there have been lots of people who continued not to have any health insurance at all. So the good news about the Affordable Care Act, the reforms that President Obama pushed through, is that many more people now have access to health insurance. The bad news is that they have access to it because their premiums are being subsidized by the taxpayers, and those premiums are paying the same ridiculously high bills at hospitals and at clinics and everywhere else that have eaten away at the system for two decades. It's almost as if the healthcare economy is an alternate universe where everybody except the doctors and the nurses is getting rich. No one experienced the recession in the healthcare economy. Everybody just kept making more and more money because the prices are just way too high. It's that simple. And unfortunately, Obamacare really does nothing to change that. It just injects more customers at the taxpayers' expense into that system.
We say healthcare industry, and we tend to lump different categories all together, but it turns out profit margins are vastly different from, say, the insurance business to the hospital business to the drug and device business.
That's exactly right. What may surprise people is that the so-called nonprofit hospitals in every city and town across the country are typically quite profitable. They have high profit margins. The pharmaceutical companies and the device makers, people who make artificial hips and knees, are extremely profitable. What's not so profitable is health insurance, because in that respect, they're on the same end of the equation that we are. They're paying those bills with us. So if you look at the profit and loss statements of the large health insurance companies, they're pretty weak. If you look at the profit and loss statements of the drug companies or the device makers, they're higher than almost any other industry you can imagine. For example, one of the large device makers, Medtronic, has double the gross profit margin that Apple has. And Medtronic makes everything, you know, everything you can imagine, from defibrillators to pacemakers to wheelchairs to, scalpels that surgeons use. And they're just able to charge an enormous amount of money because healthcare is just not a marketplace. It's not a free market the way everything else we buy is.
Right. So no matter how value conscious you are, there are times in your need for healthcare that you're just in no position to comparison shop.
Well, you're in no position at all. First of all, you don't know what you need. Yeah. You have no idea what the price is going to be. And even after you get the bill, you have no idea of what you paid for. It's not like, if you wake up this morning and decide, gee, I think I'm going to consider buying a new smartphone. So you walk into a Verizon store or you go online and, look at what Apple has. You go to Consumer Reports and you compare their quality ratings on reliability and features and all the rest of that stuff. You compare prices, and then you can decide which one to buy. Or you can actually decide, you know what, they're both too expensive. Everything's too expensive. I think I'll stick with the phone I have. None of that applies to healthcare. You don't wake up in the morning and say, gee, I think I'll wander down to the emergency room today and see what they have on sale. I'll check out their prices. If I don't like it, maybe I'll go across the street to the other emergency room. There's nothing like that. And the United States alone, among all the countries in the developed world, has lived in the illusion that you can have a private sector marketplace. I'll give you one example that is sort of emblematic of how absurd the whole thing is, which is recounted in my book. While I was finishing the reporting of the book, purely as a matter of chance, because I didn't plan it this way, I had a sudden need for open heart surgery. So I went into the hospital. I was treated very well. I got great care. And after I got out, 2 or 3 weeks later, I got 36 different explanations of benefits from my health insurance company, UnitedHealthcare. And I figured, well, I'm supposed to be an expert on this stuff. I've been writing about it. I really know this. And, I have a lot of time because I'm recovering from my surgery. So I, I relished the opportunity of opening the 36 envelopes. And, needless to say, the fact that there were 36 different envelopes tells you something right off about the efficiency of the system.
Right.
The third envelope I opened, the third explanation of benefits, said amount billed, zero, amount you owe, $152. And I looked at it. I looked at the codes. They have codes on these things. I looked at the codes. I couldn't understand it. My wife, who's also a lawyer, as I have also been trained, looked at it. She couldn't understand it. Well, as it happened, a couple of weeks later, I had scheduled an interview for the reporting I was doing for the book with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. And I went out as soon as I could travel to do the interview. I asked him the questions I wanted to ask him about, lobbying over Obamacare, the various deals and lobbying that had gone on, how it was going to affect the healthcare industry. And then, a very cordial, very informative conversation. And then at the end, I took out that explanation of benefits. I took that out of my pocket, handed it across the conference room table to him, and said, I'm wondering if you can help me with something. Could you explain this to me? Amount billed zero, amount you owe, $154. And he looked at it, and he looked at it, and he looked at it, and then he looked up at me and said, I could sit here all day, and I couldn't decode that for you. I have no idea what it means, and I have no idea why they sent it to you. And I said, well, aren't you they? It's your company. And the point isn't, that I got him in a gotcha moment. The point is that explanation of benefits, as all your listeners know, is probably the single most frequent form of communication in that any consumer gets in what is by far the largest industry in a country that thinks of itself as having this great, vibrant, free market competitive economy. And if the CEO of the company who sends out 10 millions of these things every day, if he doesn't understand what it means, how are the rest of us supposed to understand what it means?
Stephen, why can't we understand what things cost? I was really surprised that the law didn't require some kind of transparency to the extent that we could have like a Kelley Blue Book value that we use for like buying a used car to know the actual cost of, say, getting, an endoscopy or something.
Well, lately there have been movements afoot in various states to force that kind of transparency, but it actually only has limited value. For example, I needed open heart surgery. It would really be difficult for a hospital to say exactly what it was going to cost because, I could have developed a complication. I could have needed, four different kinds of blood tests a day instead of three different kinds of blood tests. So having that kind of transparency is not, the be-all and the end-all. More important, there are parts of the system that can be very transparent, but they don't do you any good. There's a couple who I write about in the book from Ohio who find out the husband has been diagnosed with cancer. And he and his wife go to the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And before he is admitted, they tell him that the insurance he thinks he has is no good because it limits him to $2,000 a day coverage in a hospital. And at MD Anderson, you really can't get weighed for $2,000. So, excuse me. Instead, they tell him that the first 3 or 4 days or 5 days of his treatment there, including them scoping out his illness and developing just a treatment plan, and then giving him just the first of the transfusions that he's going to need for several months, those first few days are estimated to cost $83,900. So he knows what the cost is going to be. But they tell him, you've got to give us the cash in advance because your insurance is not going to work. So he had a lot of transparency. He didn't have the money, and he's being held in a room downstairs before he can see the doctor until his wife basically maxes out her credit card, her mother's credit card, her mother's checking account, and he's held there waiting for the check to clear. So transparency is not the be-all and the end-all, but it's certainly a good step.
Stephen Brill is with us. He's a journalist and founder of the Yale Journalism Initiative. His new book is called America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Back in 2 minutes with journalist Stephen Brill.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Stephen Brill about his new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Stephen, how did now President Obama become committed to a healthcare overhaul as a signature ambition of his presidency? And how did his approach evolve from the Democratic primary to the general election to the effort to get the bill passed once he was in the White House?
Well, that's one of the most interesting aspects of the narrative. And, you know, the book really narrates how Obamacare happened, what the historical precedent was, but more important, all the politicking and the backroom deals and how it affects everybody's health care and their health care bills. And one of the great ironies is that President Obama didn't start out the campaign as a champion of health care reform. Actually, Hillary Clinton Hillary Clinton was attacked by President Obama, by then-Senator Obama, during the 2008 primary, because Hillary Clinton was in favor of reform that included the individual mandate that is now, you know, the centerpiece of the president's law. And the president actually distributed literature in Ohio and in other battleground states attacking her for forcing people to buy health insurance. However, during the campaign, and this is what he told me as I was doing the book, he met so many people, as did all the candidates, whose lives and pocketbooks had been affected by some healthcare tragedy, that he really saw that he needed to do it. There were people, you know, who would come up to him on the stump in Iowa and say, you know, my wife had cancer and our insurance wasn't enough, or I can't get insurance because I have a pre-existing condition and I was bankrupted, or I lost my job and I lost my health insurance, and now my kids can't go to the doctor, that he took it on. And he deserves a tremendous amount of credit because, as you'll recall, right after the inauguration, there was so much pressure on him just to focus on the economy and the crisis that the economy was in. And he insisted that he wanted to do health care, too. So he proceeded. Now, the book then recounts a kind of sorry tale of lobbying by everybody. This was like the lobbyist World Series, because, again, healthcare is literally one-sixth of our economy. And as a result, the healthcare industry spends four times as much on lobbying as the next largest lobbying player, which is the military-industrial complex. So there were lobbyists representing various diseases. There were lobbyists representing, the medical device makers, people who make mammography equipment, and, of course, the drug industry, the insurance industry, the doctors, the medical device industry, just everybody, people you couldn't even imagine would hire lobbyists, the tanning bed industry, because one of the suggestions was there should be a tax on the use of tanning beds in order to help offset the cost of the new law. So he really got into it, and he stuck with it during what was really, as the book recounts, a roller coaster ride, and he just kept at it. And there were three or four occasions when it looked like the whole thing was just dead, and he persisted, and he did it. Now, what we got as a result, however, was the kind of law that the lobbyists would allow. And what I mean by that is the pharmaceutical industry basically cut a deal, a backroom deal, that said, okay, we'll support healthcare reform as long as the reform doesn't include anything that's going to cut into our profits. So, for years, the Democrats had wanted to allow people to order drugs from Canada, where because Canada, like every other country in the world, has price controls, you could get the same drug in the same packaging for 40 or 50% less. The pharmaceutical industry wanted to make sure that a law would stay on the books that they had lobbied for that doesn't allow Medicare, which is the largest consumer of drugs in the world, that doesn't allow Medicare to bargain for the price of drugs and basically forces Medicare to pay whatever the pharmaceutical industry says they should pay for the drugs. So the pharmaceutical industry said, if you drop those reforms, if you just, let us dodge those bullets, we'll support it. And the reason we'll support it is what Obamacare is going to do is create all these new customers, because all these new people will have insurance and be able to buy our products at the same inflated prices that everybody else buys our products at in the United States, but that nobody else pays in any other country. And the same thing happened with the hospital industry. They said, as long as you don't push us, too much and do real cost reforms, such as capping the profits that nonprofit hospitals can make, capping the salaries they can pay their CEOs, as long as you don't do any of that really bad stuff, we'll support it, because now all these new people are going to show up at our hospital who have health insurance and can pay our bills.
Where do the surplus revenues go for nonprofit hospitals if they don't have shareholders to pay off?
That's a great question. Where they go is, first of all, very high salaries for everybody. The CEO of MD Anderson, which is part of the University of Texas system, makes a lot more money than the chancellor of the University of Texas. The same thing with the CEO of the University of Texas Hospital. I think it's called Southwest Texas. That's near Dallas.
UT Southwest.
So it goes. Yes. So it goes for high, very high salaries, and it goes for continuous new building and new research, which is a good thing. Remember, we have to look at the other side of the equation, as I point out in the book. It's not like all these people who are making so much money in healthcare are waking up in the morning and going to the office and producing, porn or violent, video games. They're doing God's work. They are curing the sick. So they might build a new building. They might start a new specialty at the hospital. They might hire new doctors. But all of that happens in the context of a system where only 65% of all the hospital beds in the country are being used. So there's tremendous overcapacity. And what it starts to look like and feel like is a lot of the criticism that has been extended at higher education. More buildings, more courses taught that, duplicate the courses that are at universities nearby. Very high salaries for those in charge, which get higher the bigger the university gets. The difference with higher education is that at least it's competitive. at least you can look across a community or look across the country and say, well, that tuition is this much and it's not worth it. I think I'll go here. Or, you know, maybe I won't go at all because the tuition's not worth it. With healthcare, you don't get to make any of those choices.
Stephen, a lot of people believe, and certainly Big Pharma has done nothing to disabuse people of this notion, that the inflated prices that we feel we're paying for drugs in this country may be unfair, but in fact subsidize research that benefits not only the United States, but the entire world. What did you find out about that?
Well, that is the pharmaceutical company's favorite belief. And you know, as you know, I'm a big stickler for, you know, intrepid, inquisitive journalism. And it doesn't take that much to figure out that this is a myth. You just have to look at the financial reports that these companies file every year with the SEC, and you'll see that the amounts they spend on research and development are relatively small, and they could easily spend those amounts and get the high profits that they have. Indeed, the profit margins I'm talking about, the net profit margins of drug companies, are super high. And net profit margins means that's after they've spent all this money on research and development. The second thing I'd point out is that we have a healthcare economy that is crippling this country. And I wasn't aware that any of us had signed up for a system that is subsidizing research and development in order to keep the prices low in Germany or France or England or Japan. Now, again, I think that's a myth, but even if it were true, it would be pretty hard to justify. I mean, why are we the only country in the developed world that doesn't acknowledge that if you have a drug that is a life-saving drug that has a patent, that is a monopoly on something that can save someone's life? You cannot expect that to be able to function in a free marketplace where the consumer has any leverage at all. You either pay the price or you die. And there are laws in Washington that say that any drug, for example, any cancer drug that the FDA has approved, no insurance company or Medicare can disallow because it's, you know, for example, 8 times as expensive as another cancer drug, which everybody says is just as good. You have to allow the doctor and the patient to choose the expensive drug. So that's one of the great myths, and it's a myth because, frankly, reporters just don't bother to look at what is really the simple math here.
We should say another thing the pharmaceutical industry bucked against was a proposal to do effectiveness studies that would affect which drugs get prescribed to whom.
Right. So there's a this is one of the more interesting little sub-narratives in the book, where there's this fight over something called comparative effectiveness. And what comparative effectiveness means, and what it started out saying in the legislation that got drafted, is that an independent board of, you know, peer reviewer doctors and scientists would be appointed, and it would study, for example, the comparative effectiveness of two cancer drugs. And let's say cancer drug A costs $1,000 a dose, and cancer drug B costs $100 a dose. And let's say this group decided that cancer drug B was just as good as cancer drug A. The toughest legislation that was drafted simply said that study could be made public and the panel could recommend but not require Medicare or the private insurance companies to disallow use of the $1,000 drug in favor of the $100 drug. No one was forcing anybody to do anything. It would just put the information out there. When the lobbyists got finished with that, it became something where they couldn't recommend anything. And the panel is now overseen by a board that includes members of the drug industry, the device industry, and all the industry players. And there's been huge criticism that this panel has basically done nothing to deal with the nitty-gritty questions of comparative effectiveness. And the drug lobby fought that like mad.
Stephen Brill is with us. He's founder of the Yale Journalism Initiative and author of the new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. We will come back to our conversation with Stephen Brill in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Stephen Brill, founder of the Yale Journalism Initiative and author of the new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen, for the ACA to work for the insurance industry, the idea all along was to bring young and healthy people on board, along with those who had struggled before with exclusion due to like pre-existing conditions. Has that worked?
Yes, it has. It's worked almost as much as they hoped it would work in the first year, and they continue to make progress. As I explain in the book, I think they could have made more progress if they hadn't been gun-shy about emphasizing the subsidies available to people who make up to 400% of the poverty level. So there are subsidies available to much of the middle class who buy insurance. And the Obama administration, I think, was gun-shy about emphasizing just what a significant, shall we call it, income redistribution program, aid program, welfare program. Those have, I guess, become, dirty words for the Democrats. So, you know, I'll bet you people listening probably don't realize that if you're 28 or 30 years old and you're making, you know, a starting salary, you've just started out in life of, you know, $30,000 or $35,000, you might pay $40 or $50 or $60 a month for pretty good health insurance. The premium might be $500 a month, but the subsidy you get under the law is such that your actual cost comes really down. I think as more people become aware of that, especially young people, they're much more likely to sign up. But all the predictions that this would be, you know, a demographic crisis where only old people would sign up, all of those have proven to be wrong.
When the president said, if you like your health care, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your coverage, you can keep your coverage. Was he aware that that statement would not be true for everyone?
I think he was intellectually aware of it. I know his staff was aware of it. And as I recount in the book, there were internal fights and emails and everything saying the policy staff and the economic staff kept telling the political staff and the speechwriters, you really can't say that because it's not really true. And let's go back to the couple that I talked about before from Ohio who had the cancer and was stopped downstairs at MD Anderson. They had health insurance. They had started a small business. They were making $40,000 a year. And the best insurance they could buy, they bought for $469 a month, which is actually a lot of money if you're only making $40,000 a year. And that's the insurance that limited them to $2,000 a day in the hospital. And there were all sorts of other limits. That's not really health insurance. And that's exactly the kind of health insurance that was disallowed under Obamacare. Now, if you had asked this couple, who are Republicans and who didn't support the president, if they liked their insurance before he got cancer, they would have said, in fact, they told me, they did like their insurance because they didn't know it wasn't insurance. Now they are signed up under Obamacare for full coverage, and they're paying about the same amount that they were paying for that lousy coverage. So it was, you know, very poor communication. They basically tried to simplify the issue, and the rationale of the speechwriting staff and the political staff was, well, we can't say if you like your insurance, you can keep your insurance, unless you have really lousy insurance, and then we're going to take it away from you, because that requires a long explanation, as witnessed by the fact that it just took me, 2 or 3 minutes to explain that to you.
Has the overall impact of the ACA been less in states like Texas, where undocumented immigrants have always made up a significant proportion of the uninsured and do not qualify for subsidies, and that will continue to be the case?
Well, there's that, but the real lack of impact in Texas results from the fact that Governor Perry refused to allow Medicaid to be expanded. The Supreme Court, when it upheld the law, also ruled that the federal government couldn't force the states to expand Medicaid to cover everyone who's below the poverty line, and Texas doesn't. So most states volunteered to do it because, guess what, the federal government is paying 100% of those costs, winding down to 90%. And anyone who's looked at it objectively said this is a no-brainer. The federal government is going to cover all these poor people. It's great for the hospitals in every state because those people will now come to our emergency rooms with insurance that can pay for their care. It's just great all around. But a few, frankly, very partisan Republican governors just refused to expand it at all. And that has really hurt the benefits of Obamacare in those states. And plus, you have this sort of through-the-looking-glass situation where if I make $28,000 a year in Texas, I will be able to pay maybe $40, $50, $60 a month for my health insurance because I'll get a subsidy. But I'm not below the poverty level. If I make $18,000 a year and I want insurance, I'll have to pay $1,000 because I'm not entitled to a subsidy because the way the law was written, anyone below the poverty level wouldn't buy insurance on the exchanges where the subsidies apply. They would be put into an expanded Medicaid program. So when those governors refused to expand Medicaid, those people who were too poor to get a subsidy were left out.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Elliot on the line in Dallas. Hello, Elliot.
Hello, Chris. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And I wanted to thank Mr. Brill because it has been a bitter pill for my partner and I. Just real quickly, we're low-income business owners. Before the act, we could depend on such things as Ryan White Foundation and the Texas Health Department to help us with our medical problems. Now with the insurance, it's all been thrown out that window. And, you know, our income hasn't changed, but yet now it costs us approximately $4,000 a year just to keep up with the medication and everything else. So it has not turned out. I wish I had a lobbyist in Washington. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Ellie.
Well, that's your last point is the point, which is the only way this is ever going to change, I think, and I say at the end of the book, is when it becomes enough of a crisis for enough people that – when there is a crisis is the only time when lobbyists no longer hold sway because the population as a general matter rises up and, you know, those who elect them have to pay attention to them. Right now, you know, there are thousands of people who woke up this morning who the only thing they're thinking about is how they lobby for the healthcare industry. And they're thinking about making sure that something doesn't get changed that will raise will lower the profits of the drug industry, for example. When you woke up this morning, you had other things to worry about and think about than that. And that, in a nutshell, is why we have the crisis we have in this country.
Do you think we would be better off with a single-payer system based on your research?
Well, yes, but, you know, I also wish it were.
It's never going to happen,
Christmas.
Right? Yeah, in the United States.
It's not going to happen. It could have happened, as I recount in the book. In 1943, a little-known bureaucratic agency called the War Labor Board, which President Roosevelt appointed during the war to control wages, decided that employers who were suddenly trying to use health insurance as a way to raise wages without looking like they were raising wages, that health insurance would not count as a wage increase. And that precipitated a flood of large employers buying health insurance for their workers. The IRS then ruled in an equally obscure decision that because it wasn't considered a wage increase, it wouldn't be considered taxable income. Once we went down that road, we were down that road forever because the push to have a government-sponsored health insurance wouldn't have the backing of all the people who had insurance on their jobs, which were a large chunk of the population. And ironically, in the 1940s and 50s, one of the key sources of opposition to single-payer government health care was, guess what? The progressive unions, because the unions were offering that to their members. And they told President Roosevelt and his staff, you know, don't you do this, because this is one of our great recruiting tools. So that's why it never happened in the United States.
Stephen Brill has written for Time, The New Yorker, and The New York Times Magazine. His new book is called America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen, it's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for mentioning me in your pledge, which I hope everybody responds to. You guys are doing great work.
Thanks.